Now, I can't start class without extra cough drops and a Kleenex. So please forgive me. We are in Acts chapter 21. We're going to pick up where we left off toward the end of Acts chapter 21. Paul's mission journey and his mission work is taking a hard left turn, and his approach to his call from Christ to be the word of Jesus as Lord throughout the world is going to have to change tactics. As he's arrested, he's moving from pure evangelism to what he calls a defense. He says he's making his defense, and it is a defense, but I think it's interesting that his defense is mostly Jesus is Lord. So he finds a way to integrate his defense with his call to evangelize, which I find fascinating. So let's go to Acts chapter 21. We got through most of it last week. We're going to pick up in verse 27. So Acts 21 and verse 27 is where we left off last week as Paul is arrested. So open your Bibles and read with me there if you would, please. When 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place. And besides, he's brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul, and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. While they were still trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. The commander came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing and some another, and since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great, he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him." Let's stop there. All right, so Paul was trying to avoid a scene when he was in Jerusalem. You remember when he first came there, he was approached and said, "There's many thousands of Jews that are zealous for the law, and they've heard that you are speaking against the law and telling people not to follow the law of Moses, and so join these men in their purification rites." And that's what he means at the very beginning of this in verse 27 when he says, "When the 7 days were nearly over," this is the 7 days for their purification. So Paul's attempt to avoid a scene evidently does not work. He is trying to show the Jews that he's zealous, or the Jewish converts, that he's zealous for the law. I guess probably all Jews. And he's still living in obedience to the law, as referenced back in verse 24. And he's right in the midst of trying to show that, trouble finds him in verse 27. That 7 days in verse 27 refers to the purification rites Paul's participating in. And these men who took the vow will shave their heads at the altar, and each one at the end of the vow will sacrifice a sin offering and a burnt offering as prescribed in Numbers chapter 6, verse 9 and following. But while Paul is at the temple tending to the purification rites, some Jews from Asia stir up the whole crowd and they seized Paul. Paul's whole purpose, or Paul's whole agenda, has been from all through chapter 21, all the way back to chapter 20, to reach Jerusalem by the day of Pentecost. So Jerusalem is swelling in size with pilgrims coming to the city for the Pentecost celebration. And so there are, by one estimation, five times the number of the normal population in Jerusalem. This is a city that's packed with people. And so what's fascinating here is Paul is accused of doing the very thing that these purification rites were meant to dissuade, to prove that Paul is a faithful Israelite. And so they're meant to avoid defiling the temple. And yet Trophimus is traveling with Paul, And presumably, back in chapter 20, verse 4, we've talked about those from the province of Asia, and those who were joining with Paul on the trip to Jerusalem, quite possibly, most likely as stewards of the money that their region had donated for the believers in Jerusalem. So there are people who have taken donations, and there are some who seem to go as those who are overseers of that for their particular congregation or their area. That's probably what Trophimus is doing with Paul in Jerusalem. And there's some Jews that are there, presumably for the celebration of Pentecost, who recognize him as one from their province, and worse than that, a Greek. So there's no evidence anywhere in any place, in any writing I've ever read or looked at, that suggests that Paul ever violated the temple, that he ever defiled the temple, that he ever brought a Gentile anywhere near the temple. And really, honestly, that's not what the Jews are upset about. If you look at verse 28, we're told what they're upset about. Now, they were shouting, "Men of Israel, help us, this man who teaches all men everywhere against our people, against our law, against this place," speaking of the temple. So they're mad at Paul because Paul is not behaving the way they think he should. They believe he's attacking their real identity, the core of their identity, the heart of their identity. They're Jewish people with the Jewish law and the Jewish temple, and Paul doesn't respect any of those. And so it's not a big leap of logic to think, well, if this man doesn't respect any of those things that identify who we are, then it's not much of a step for him to defile who we are and what we're about by bringing a Gentile into the temple. So evidently that's not a hard case to make against Paul because of their frustration with him. And so here again, Paul's a lightning rod for controversy. He seems to be kind of good at that. So as the anger and the frustration and the intensity of the mob increases, evidently that also amps up Paul in verse 30. And so the first order of business is to drag Paul away from the temple. And there's a sense here, if you notice, look at the latter part of verse 30, the beginning of the first part of verse 30. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running in all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple. And what happened immediately after that? The doors are shut. The gates are shut. What's going on there? Why is that little bit of information there at the end included? What does that tell us? They dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates or the doors are shut. Okay, we're going to do this behind closed doors. We don't want to see what has happened. Okay, what else? I'm sorry, they don't want to allow certain people in. We're going to try to stop this. So he's dragged out of the temple, and immediately the temple keepers shut the door. We're going to try to keep the unseemly acts that are going to take place with Paul away from the holy temple. We're going to keep the temple from being defiled any further. We're going to keep our holy place holy. Now, what we do outside the holy place may not be all that holy. What we're going to do with Paul, but we're going to keep our holy place holy. So they're trying to keep the temple from being defiled any further. They want to keep the trouble outside the sacred area rather than in the sacred area. And this reaches the ear of the commander of the Roman troops. Some of your translations say the cohort or the garrison, verse 31. Adjacent to and attached to the wall of the temple is the fortress of Antonia, the Roman garrison or the Roman cohort. And in this Roman garrison, this cohort is usually made up of 760 infantrymen, 240 cavalry. There's 1,000 soldiers, some of them on horseback. They shouldn't have any problem putting this down. There should be no issue stopping this mob. So as soon as the commander learns of the uproar, he took some of the officers, verse 32, runs down to the crowd, and this is sufficient. This deployment of soldiers is sufficient to momentarily interrupt Paul's beating. And here we see the prophecy of Agabus coming to pass. You remember Agabus told him what would happen when he came there. He took the robe and tied his hands and said, this will happen to you. And what I find fascinating in verse 33 and following, the Roman commander takes charge, and he doesn't know what the problem is, but he seems to make an automatic assumption as to who the problem is. And what's fascinating is there's a whole mob mad. There's one guy getting beat up, and it's the guy that's getting beat up. It must be his fault. I'm sure there's logic in there somewhere. So after stopping the beating, the commander takes Paul into custody. And then the commander asked Paul who he was and who are you and what have you done? Okay, so you may not, part of me says, okay, that's wise strategy, because if everybody's mad at one guy, then probably he's the instigator. Another part of me thinks it's a whole lot easier to go against one guy than to go against an angry mob. And so if you have to pick somebody to make the enemy, it's a whole lot easier to make this one guy getting beat up the enemy than it is to make the mob the enemy. And as far as a Roman, what's his first concern? If he's a Roman soldier there in Jerusalem, in charge with overseeing the city, and now the city's growing to five times its normal population with pilgrims coming in, what is this Roman commander's first priority? Keep the peace. Stop the chaos. Pax Romana, the Roman peace. He will not get in trouble there's hardly anything he'll get in trouble for faster with his commanders than allowing a mob to riot, ruining the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And so if he removes Paul, he removes the instigator, he removes the powder keg, and he can gain control yet again. So he asks Paul, who are you and what have you done? And in verse 34, the mob is so much worked up that he can't even get an answer. He can't get a straight answer. So he decides to move Paul to the relative quiet of the barracks. There were steps. The wall of the Roman temple, or the Jerusalem temple, and the fortress of Antonia shared a common wall. And there were steps leaving the temple court up to the fortress. So the steps, you climb up to the fortress of Antonia. The soldiers come down, they grab Paul, they try to question him there, and there's just too much chaos, and so they decide they'll take him back into the barracks. The problem is verse 35, the mob makes that impossible. They are bent on having their way with Paul, and they are not going to let him get away with it. And so to protect Paul and to hasten the retreat, the soldiers carry him up the stairs. I hope you catch the irony there. This is almost as ironic as Balaam's donkey chastising him for not seeing God's servant. Imagine you are an Israelite and you are in Jerusalem for this holy day of Pentecost, and you are one of the pilgrims, whether you live in Jerusalem or you've come as a pilgrimage, and you've lived your entire life with the promise of a coming Messiah. And you have looked forward to coming Messiah. It's almost like you and me waiting for Christ to return. We know he's going to return. Didn't return in our parents' time. He didn't return in our grandparents' time. He hasn't returned yet in our time. But we know he's coming. And hopefully we're prepared and ready and even anxious, come Lord Jesus, come. They're the same way with the Messiah. Now the Messiah's come, and now we have an apostle of the Messiah coming out and proclaiming. And if you had told us Israelites back before all this started that when the Messiah comes, the proclaimer of the Messiah will be, his life will be in danger by the Israelites and saved by the Romans, you'd go, nah. No way. If somebody's going to come and tell us the Messiah is here, we're going to flock to him and we're going to embrace him and we're going to be excited about that and we're going to celebrate that. And the Romans are always the problem. They're not the solution. And so now the tide has turned and Paul is in danger by his own people. And the ones who save him are the Romans. There's a great irony there. Verse 36, Paul's carried away. And what does the angry mob keep shouting? Away with him. Does that sound familiar? Is there ever another time when somebody was told, away with him? Away with him. Give us Barabbas. So there's an echo here. There's an echo. Against the law, and our people, and our temple. It's okay, we can murder out there. Okay, all right, great point, Jim. Wonderful irony. Have you ever known anybody, and none of us have ever been this person, but have you ever known anybody that was on their best behavior at church? And then you run into them out in public? And they're not quite the same person they were at church. There's a comedian that tells a story about a church member who calls him and just cusses him out for something. I don't remember what it was, but she didn't. And then he realizes that she's a church member. Have you ever known anybody that, you know, they're nice and gracious and put on their best clothes and their best behavior, but don't get in front of them in the parking lot? That's what we've got here. We're going to be holy in the holy place, but when we get past the holy place, we're going to shut the doors, and the holy place can be holy, but we're going to take care of business out here. That seems to be so. Another great irony. Thank you, Jim. Luke chapter 23, verse 18, as Jesus is arrested and Pilate tries to give them Jesus back because he knows he's an innocent man, and he gives them the choice. And he write, and it says, Luke 23:18, with one voice they cried out, "Away with this man, release Barabbas to us." So here's the echo of what happened with Christ. Paul is walking in Christ's footsteps, which he said he wanted to do in Philippians, and he's doing. So here we have a turning point in Paul's ministry. This begins the period of imprisonment for Paul that lasts at least 5 years, if not more. And during this time, Paul does his best to continue to be evangelist, but he spends a lot of his time defending himself. So help me with this. I'm trying to make a connection there that Paul is struggling to continue to be the evangelist while also defending himself. And what every time Paul defends himself, what is his defense? Just kind of, if you can think back on what Paul says when he defends himself. He talks about his Damascus Road experience. He talks about his commission from the Jesus who speaks to him from the clouds. And he talks about his eyes being blinded, and he talks about his being released. But basically, his whole defense is, I had an experience with the Messiah. The Messiah gave me a job. I'm doing my job. Right? That's pretty much the his job is to proclaim Jesus is the Christ. By the way, don't forget that. So my claim is that's Paul's determination to continue his evangelism even in the face of his own persecution. And I'm open to be wrong with this. I'm open to be, you're welcome to change my mind. This is not the hill I want to die on. But I kind of wonder if it was you or me making a defense. It might be a little less about our commission and more about our innocence. I've never brought a Gentile to the temple. I've never defiled the temple. I've never done anything to defile the temple. There's no proof of that. You know, give proof of any of that. I've always, now he'll do some of the, I've always been faithful. I've always, he'll do some of his own resume. But the theme of what Paul says over and over again in his defense is, I got a commission. I've been truthful to the commission. Jesus is Lord. So my claim is, he is doing his best in the midst of his defense, or integrating his defense into his call to be an evangelist. I tell you what, let's just kind of keep that in the back of our minds, and we'll test that as we go through. And when we get through, you can tell me if you think we're on some subject or not. Yes. He could have walked away from that easily enough. Yeah. And I've always kind of I've always kind of teased about Paul being the crazy guy that every time there's a crowd, he thinks it's a good time to preach. That's really not a fair characterization, because when he sees a crowd, he thinks he's compelled to preach. He has to preach because that's his commission. He doesn't have a choice but to preach. It doesn't matter if the crowd is willing to hear him, if it's a favorable crowd, or if it's a mob that wants to kill him. I think Paul feels compelled. I don't think Paul feels like he has a chance. If there's an opportunity to proclaim the gospel, especially if there's a crowd to do it in front of, I think Paul feels like he must preach. Not just he's not the guy that just automatically triggers, I see a crowd, it's a good time to preach. I think he feels, I'm coming to the point, and maybe I'm coming late to the table. Maybe you've been there a lot longer than I have. I'm coming to the point to really sense to feel the weight of the commission that Paul had received. Not just the weight of the commission, but the weight of the commission backed up by the circumstances around the commission. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? I really think Paul had a burden to try to make up for some of the damage he did to Jesus. Why are you persecuting me and his church? And I don't think he ever felt like he came anywhere close to making up for that. I think he always felt like he was way behind the curve. Probably never felt like he ever could make up for that. So I still hold to the Paul being the crazy guy that every time there's a crowd, he thinks it's time to preach, but not because he's just a crazy guy, but because he feels a burden to fulfill the commission that he was given. Probably part ways because of guilt over this past, and part over astonishment that this same Jesus who he was persecuting would allow him to serve in that capacity rather than just dismiss him as an enemy of the gospel. So I'm kind of coming to the point where I'm kind of feel like Paul just had this this thorn in his side, this constant nagging every time. You ever had a sticker in your foot, and every time you take a step, it's like, oh. I think every time Paul moved, it was like, I got to preach. I've got to serve Christ. I've got to do my commission. I'm starting to feel that more and more. So, if you're already there, you know, thanks for letting me come to the table late. But that's kind of where I'm landing here. There was a hand back here. Was it? Were you Donnell? Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you know, if God came to me on the road, blinded me, and did all of that, I mean, that thorn in my side would compel me. Every opportunity I get, I'm gonna tell people, I'm gonna try to bring somebody.
You'll never feel like you've satisfied that responsibility. And I kind of think that's where he's at. Jim? Robert Prater?
Yeah. You knew that, but you never bothered to bring that to my attention.
Right.
You remember him making that?
Yeah, the great debacle. You stand next to somebody on Judgment Day, and then you get the welcome in, good and faithful servant, and they get, depart from me, I never knew you. And they said, you knew that the whole time, and you didn't tell me that? Right. That's his defense. I'm doing what I was told to do. I'm following the directions. Yeah. Yeah. And I hope Robert Prater's illustration, and he's like every other preacher. We seldom have a new and fresh thought. Usually our thoughts come from somebody else that we're studying and reading. And so that's been said before many, many times. I hope that weighs on our hearts. Heaven help us if we stand next to somebody at Judgment Day that we've known and haven't shared the gospel. And if they're lost because God put us in their life to share the gospel and we didn't. I hope that's a burden for us, like Paul's commission is a burden for him. Some burdens are healthy, and I hope that's a burden for us like it was for him. All right, so Paul's focus changes from pure evangelism to evangelism/defense. And during this 5 years that he's incarcerated, during a lot of this time, Luke spends much of it with Paul, and this is when he carefully investigates everything regarding the advent of Christ. And he says from Luke chapter 1, verse 3, he's investigated from the beginning. A lot of the time that Paul's incarcerated, Luke's with him, and that's when he does a lot of his investigation. That's when he does a lot of his homework. And so Luke Acts is his orderly account of this investigation. So, remember the theme of Acts? God's not letting anyone or anything stop the advance of the gospel. All right. Shall we press on? We'll come to 21:37, and then we'll jump into 22. The theme behind what we're going to look at for the remainder of tonight is in chapter 1, verse 28. Paul is teaching against our people, the Jews, against our law, the covenant, and against our place, the temple. And so this will be kind of the background, the base for everything else that we talk about. And so let's look at Paul's speech to the crowd. I've tried to find a way to break this up, and there's a long reading, longer than I like, so please stay awake. But I haven't found a way to break it up that I like any better than the long reading, so we're just bear with the long reading. Y'all ready? Take a deep breath, put on your jogging shoes, let's go. 21:37. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." They'd previously seen Trophimus and the Ephesian in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. We're backtracking because I thought we'd do this on a different day. The whole city was aroused and the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down into the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. The commander came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Then he asked him who he was and what he had done. Some of the crowd shouted one thing and some another, and since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. When Paul reached the steps, now we're blazing some new territory. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great that he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him." As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you?" "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Paul answered, "I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic, one translation said Hebrews, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense." When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Then Paul said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of the way to their death, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison, as also the high priest and all the council can testify. I even obtained letters from them to their brothers in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. About noon, as I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?' 'Who are you, Lord?' I asked. 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting,' he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. 'What shall I do, Lord?' I asked. 'Get up,' the Lord said, 'and go to Damascus. There you will be told all that you have been assigned to do.' My companions led me by the hand into Damascus because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. A man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me and said, "Brother Saul, receive your sight." And at that very moment, I was able to see him. Then he said, "The God of our fathers has chosen you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear words from his mouth. You will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now, what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on his name." When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance and saw the Lord speaking. "Quick," he said to me, "leave Jerusalem immediately, because they will not accept your testimony about me." "Lord," I replied, "these men that know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him." Then the Lord said to me, "Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles." We'll stop there. So if you notice, Paul never wavers from his commission. His commission is that Christ chose him as an instrument to carry Christ's name to both the people of Israel and the Gentiles. That comes from 9:15. We're back in chapter 21, and he's saying the same thing. If you remember back in chapter 19, in the riot in Ephesus, Paul wanted to speak to that crowd, even while they were trying to kill him. Now, Paul describes what he wants to do here in chapter 22, verse 1, as a defense. But his defense is, Jesus is Lord. This is my defense. Jesus is Lord. The Roman commander in verse 38, chapter 21, verse 38, thinks Paul is a false prophet from Egypt. There's history there. He has reason to think that. There was an Egyptian who led a band of assassins in an attempt to take over Jerusalem in the past. And that Egyptian promised his followers that they would see the city walls fall. So there was an attempt to take over and to overthrow Jerusalem. Governor Felix crushed that revolt. But in the midst of crushing the revolt, this Egyptian leader escaped. So a lot of his followers were arrested and killed. But he escaped, and now the Roman commander thinks he's come back. He's come back to finish the job. So here's this guy. The whole city's in uproar against this guy. Who might he be? The first person that comes to the Roman commander's mind is this Egyptian. But in verse 39, Paul comes to his own defense. He denies the commander's accusations. And if you notice, now we have some personal resume here. First, he's a Jew. So if he's a Jew, what does that say about his right or not, or lack of a right to be at the temple? I have a right to be here. I'm part of the Israelite. I'm part of the clan. I'm part of the family. I have a right to be here. Second, Paul is a citizen of Tarsus. And how does he describe the city of Tarsus? Verse 39,
21, 39. Insignificant is what mine says.
Very significant.
No, insignificant.
Oh, no insignificant city. All right, what else? Anybody have it? I think most of the readings are pretty close to that. No ordinary city is what mine says. That's an interesting, some of your translations say it's no obscure city, no mean city. Basically all saying the same thing, different ways of saying the same thing. This is not Nazareth. this is a real city. This city has some substance to it. That's an interesting turn of a phrase, no mean city, no obscure city, no ordinary city. There's history to that phrase. Back in the 5th century B.C., a playwright named Euripides, once used that same phrase, no ordinary city, to describe the city of Athens. Now, Athens was a very prestigious city. Athens was the crown jewel. Yeah, exactly, the crown jewel. And so when Euripides describes Athens as no ordinary city, it was considered the center for classical civilization back in its golden age. And Athens is still remembered today as the one of the cities that laid the foundation for Western civilization. We can spend all the time you want to on that. And so by using that same phrase, calling Tarsus no ordinary city, he's not just saying this isn't Nazareth. He's saying this is a step above. This is a golden city. So that's it's a very powerful phrase he's using there. So they take him to the, they come down, the soldiers come down from the fortress of Antonia. Now they bring him back, and they go up the steps. And the beauty of going up the steps, it gives Paul a high platform from which to speak to the crowd. Now all of a sudden he's not on their level. Now he's elevated and he can speak to them. He can look down and speak to them. And so Paul addresses them, chapter 21, verse 40, from this elevated position. And in 21:40 and 22, verse 2, Paul, the mob is shocked when the crowd speaks to, when Paul speaks to the crowd in their own language. And here's the reason for that. You wouldn't be shocked that someone speaks, mine translates as Aramaic. Hebrew is probably a better translation than that. You wouldn't think it would shock a bunch of Israelites that someone speaks Hebrew to them, would you? That's their native language. But what's interesting is by the time we get to where Paul is at the temple speaking to them, the Hebrew language has fallen largely out of favor and much out of use. The Hebrew language has been dying out ever since the Jews were carried off into captivity 600 years earlier. So from that time on, the Hebrew language has been dying out, so much so that the most prominent Jewish scholar of the first century, Philo of Alexandria, he's the final word for first century scholars in Israel. The greatest Jewish scholar of the first century couldn't read the books of Moses in their original language. That's how far Hebrew had fallen out of use. And so he addresses the crowd in their language, which immediately gets their attention. And then in chapter 22, verse 1, he builds rapport. He addresses them as brothers or brethren. Some of your translations say brothers and fathers. What's he doing there? He's conveying respect. I'm one of you. Ich bin ein Berliner. Anybody? I tried that once. Ich bin ein Berliner. Yeah, President Kennedy, when the wall went up between East and West Germany, and the help went over. They were trying to help the people that were stuck in East Germany. I'm a Berliner. I'm one of you. A lot like what they said at the terrorist attacks, 9/11 terrorist attacks, where the Europeans said, we're all Americans today. Paul saying, I'm one of you, building rapport. We're all in this together, brothers and fathers, building rapport with the crowd. And we'll stop here because we have like four different themes that Paul gets into in his defense. And the first one that he's a loyal Jew. That's going to be his first defense. But we'll get into that, Lord willing, next week. Thoughts, comments? Larry?
You know, Paul tells them about his conversion.
Yes.
And that's the message he was given. And we can do the same thing about our conversion.
We can absolutely talk about our conversion, and we ought to. And not only our conversion, but what does it mean to be a Christian? Why is our life different now than it was before? How is my life different than it would have been if I hadn't become a Christian? What is Christ doing in my life now? These are all valid ways to give testimony, to give witness. And that phrase or those phrases don't always sell well or land well in our tribe, but they're very biblical. It's a very biblical concept to talk about what Christ has done and is doing in our lives. And you don't have to be a biblical scholar to do that, right? Thank you. Was there?
Kind of in line with that, one of the things Paul ever addressed was, I'm telling you what has been brought to my hearing.
Yes.
It was through my study of the Old Testament and the Old Testament.
Right.
You have been given free will by God. He loves you and he wants you to be with him.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you, this is the right direction. You have free will. You can either decide to go or not.
You can tell somebody the bridge is out. If they want to keep driving on the road toward the bridge, that's their choice. We're commanded to plant and water. Apollos planted, I watered. Yeah. Kick the dust off and move on. Yeah. We are commanded to plant and water, to proclaim the gospel. We are not held, so we're held responsible for that. We'll be held responsible if there's somebody standing next to us and they say, "Why didn't you tell me?" We're not commanded to be responsible for their choice, their decision, how they respond to the gospel. But we are commanded to do our best to proclaim it, and Paul is doing his best to proclaim it, and we'll see him continue to do that, Lord willing, next week. Thank you very much. Appreciate your help. God bless you. We are dismissed.